This podcast is for grown-ass people, so if you are under the age of 18, go away.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, it's just, you know, we're recording now. Let me adjust the boobs. Like, no one can see them.
I'll do the same so you don't
You do the same. We're both right. Adjusting our boobs here in the dark here. Yeah. Wait a minute. That's so what she said.
I want to talk about, we'll talk about the book, Fables in the Key of Kink. But before we get, I want to know, like, how we got here. Like, how did we get to this point where you decided, hey, I'm going to write about these things that were inspired by real life situations? Like, do you consider yourself more kinky or more just sexually fluid, open? Or like, what is your, where do you fall on that spectrum?
Oh, wow. You know, it's my journey into this world started pretty young. When I went away to college, we found ourselves in broadcasting and in radio specifically. And radio is a hungry, hungry beast and it needs to be fed all the time. And in real short order, I think I was maybe 19, I had found myself with full work at the university in the newsroom. In fact, I sold my first piece to NPR when I was 19 years old. So I've been a professional writer and journalist since I was a teenager. And in that, you end up staying at the college by yourself, away from family, a lot on holidays because they use those students, you know, like a commodity during those breaks. And I found that I started to hobble together family relationships that way. And I got married the same week I graduated from college. So I got married, let's just say too young, and pretty young. And in that I went from hobbling together family as my way. And in my first marriage, we did that a lot too. After a long period of time when we had children, I picked people who didn't have children of their own to be godparents. And I picked so chosen family was the entree into that. And when that all fell apart after 20 years, I realized that I had a lot of wild oats left to sow. And I took up with a fellow who was just the antidote to that first marriage, happy, fun guy, wonderful. And he'd lived a polyamorous life and had a family with children and all the rest of that in polyamory. So we kind of, and at that point he was in another town. He came to Atlanta and invited me to Frolicon here in Atlanta, which is an institution. It's every Easter weekend, or it was for years, because what would Jesus do? He'd beat a banker. Anyway. right. So what would Jesus do? He'd flip a table if not out of the realm. So I went to this and I walked in and I said, oh, wow, this is a whole new world. And there were lots of queer folk and there were lots of you know, people who were being fluid with their gender, their identity, all of this other stuff. And they had a dungeon. And so I walked into the dungeon and I'm thinking to myself, I'm getting a divorce. I'm not supposed to be here. You know, this would be bad for the divorce, I thought, in some way. But I walk into the dungeon and I looked around and I went, nope, nope. Nope. Big, tall, frosty glass. Nope, 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 and nope. And I realized after that, but my first impression was I don't think this is for me. Uh-huh. But the fella I was dating, we kind of made conventions. We made them pay for themselves by what we provided. So in that we can we were doing a lot of turnkey alcohol things, right? Sabourage was one of the things we did. Liquor tastings, alcohol. I took myself to school and became an expert in gin and port and some other things. And we would go to conventions. So somebody said, hey, come on out to what they called it, Frolicon West. They said it was just like Frolicon. Well, that was Thunder in the Mountains.
Oh, sure.
Have you been to Thunder?
I've never been, but I've heard.
Okay, well, it's not Frolicon West. Let me just start in that square. This grew out of a gay leather, male gay leather convention. And so we went there the first time expecting one thing, and their dungeon was absolutely something else entire. So in Atlanta, in the dungeon, people are in their scenes looking outward. They're looking at who's watching them. In Denver, my idea here when I observed the dungeon was these people give no fucks about who's right. watching. The self-hangers and spinners and the fire people, they were into their scene. They were pleased enough if somebody watched, but they didn't care. And that was a very interesting thing. So my reporter self took over and I started to interview some people at the buffet or whatever, you know, and I'm saying, what are you doing here? The ponies, they threw a whole thing, and the littles, they had a whole thing. And I kind of realized that the ponies have more in common with the littles than with the drag queens. You know, it's like, you kind of say like, oh, like where do these circles overlap? But I realized I was asking myself the wrong question. Do I want to do that? No, I didn't want to do that. But I looked at the space and I said, what does this space offer that I could do here that is meaningful to me, right? And so when I got there, the second time I went back to Denver, I had ideas in mind of things, scenes that I wanted to do in the dungeon that were me, very me-centric. So one of the things that I find that a dungeon doesn't see very often is laughter. They don't see funny things. So he became my husband, this person, and we went to Denver and we created a scene in the dungeon that was the executive and his secretary. And we did this whole funny scene. Oh, Mr. Jorgensen, we're Lutheran, right? Oh, Mr. Jorgensen, how you want me to take a memo, do you? Okay. Oh, my pen is fallen on the floor. And then, so then there's this whole thing under the table. And, sure. and then there's this thing on top of the table. And then one of our friends came by because we had this whole group of people who were watching this absolutely hilarious scene that we were doing in the dungeon. And, take a memo. My wife needs some jewelry. Not as good as the stuff I get for you. Okay. A lot of this, you know, so there was that. And then she walked by, hello, popping in from HR as we're, you know, on the table. And so, I mean, people were laughing and it was just something that the dungeon hadn't seen. And then the other thing I did, pardon me, was I did a whole blindfolded scene, literally with a colorful paint box. I was blindfolded and naked. And then my partner was administering was facilitating the whole scene. And I said, I'm into secrets. I was a really good investigative journalist. And I got people to tell me things they didn't want to tell. And so blindfolded on this table, if you came up to me and told me, what your secret was, something you've never told, right? If I approved, you could paint.
Oh, I got you.
And it was kind of I spent an hour in the scene listening to people, and it was fascinating what people told me. Some of it was really scary, and some of it was okay. But I'll tell you what men said their desire was, and maybe it's the environment, maybe that, but there was a number of them. Many of them who said, I want to rape women. That was truly upsetting, sure, you know, to sure. hear, but it was them being honest. But collectively between men and women, what they told me, and this is maybe something that's exchange centric, the things that the culture doesn't really provide for. There's a lot of people who told me, I'm in love with so-and-so and they don't know. And I've never told them. You know, and they confessed that particular thing. And then my personal favorite was this woman who went, I am 52 and a half years old. I've never done anything for myself. I've raised 3 children and 5 grandchildren, and I am here with a man who is not my husband, and I'm happy as hell. And I was like, good for you, sister. Good for you. And there a couple of people there said, none of this does anything for me. I don't know why I'm here. Who I am, what did that space allow? That. And right. I loved it.
It's funny you mentioned laughter in a kink scene, because I have friends who that is their thing, right?
Is
having fun, because there is that stereotype of the stern, dominant, regardless of gender, right? Mm-hmm. And a lot of people do take themselves very, very seriously in it. And there are some people who, for them, it is something very serious. And I'm not taking anything away from that. But there is something about people who love, part of their kink is flipping that on its head, right? Like yeah. That's part of it, right? Is
that may be me.
Yeah. And sometimes that, and I've been to events where something like that happened, and it was sort of like, you know, if it's a multi-day event, if something like that happens on the second day, you can kind of feel a relaxation that comes across, you know, from everyone. And from that point on, everyone's like, oh, we don't have to take ourselves too seriously here or whatever. Because it
or
can be
that good little dungeon soldier, you know.
Right.
There's that too. Yeah.
And there's also like the idea that you have to impress if you're a dominant, and you can't be fallible if you're a dominant, you know, these types of things that are, you know, very, very, you know, difficult. Or if you're, you know, submissive, you can't say no, you know, these types of things that are very, even though you would think by this time people would have, you know, it's definitely better than it was like 10, 15 years ago in terms of like, hey, you do kink your own way. But there is mm-hmm. still that thing, the domly dom who has to put on a fake, whether it's a male or female, they have to put on a fake persona because they're insecure and, you know, or they just think that's how they're supposed to act, right? But it sounds like you had a lot of fun. Do you consider yourself non-monogamous? Is that how?
You know, for the last, let me think about it now. Definitely ethically, I've done monogamy and I've done ethical non-monogamy, and I've done both with fidelity, you know, so I know how to do both. And I would say definitely the swinger, there's some great clubs in Atlanta. Swingers mm-hmm. clubs. Some of them are gritty, some of them are fancy. And I'll admit I'm a bougie bitch. I like all that kind of the fancy stuff. But I've met people there who've become friends, platonic friends even. And I would say, am I kinky? Am I BDSM-y, kinky, ethically non-monogamous swinger? Yeah, at this point, I've moved down the scale to swinger, and I've somewhat abandoned polyamory as well. I find that I know how to do it. I don't want to put my energies a mile wide and an inch deep, which can happen, you know. I want to be focused where I am. I heard somebody say one day, I want a house, not a timeshare. And I went, oh, that's an interesting way of putting it. But I can see how a lot of people could easily feel that way. And so, yeah, at this point, I'm definitely on the swinger end of things, emotionally and physically. So, you know, some of that kind of makes an appearance in the book and
yeah, well,
so forth. Yeah.
One thing I've found, cause I do, we're starting to kind of get back into the kink scene after a little bit of a break and excuse me, we always dated people together. Just one second. Swallowed Ron. Ron Hall, you think I'd have learned by now.
That's what she said.
Right. And going into the ethical non-monogamy space. So even though there's a lot of crossover, there's a lot of people who are kinky and non-monogamous. I found that there are people who are in the poly scene specifically, that if you don't say you're poly, you say, oh, I'm non-monogamous, but I'm not poly, right? Mm-hmm. It's sort of, there's a purity test of sorts. Sometimes I feel that it's kind of interesting that I found, and you kind of find this in some, you can find this in the kink scene too, every now and again. Oh, you don't practice DS in and out of the bedroom, or, oh, you don't do rope or whatever. I found that really fascinating because I never really explored like the non-monogamy community. My wife is demisexual, so swinging is out of the question, right? Mm-hmm. I'm totally a slut. I totally do it, right? but that, you know, they have plenty of guys. They have plenty of single guys out there already. So I have no.
True.
So, right. And the desire for submissive guys is even lower. So, it's definitely, it's been interesting to say the least, but the, but I found that, I don't know if you probably don't run into that in the swinger community as much of people saying, oh, what, you're not poly or non-monogamous or pure swinger, or is there some sort of purity test in the swinger community as well that you find, or?
So I find that there's, so let's take a club like we have in Atlanta, like Trapeze, right? There's a bunch of people who are there to just observe. You know, they're monogamous for every purpose, right? But they want to have some public sex in a safe space, or they want to watch other people or whatever. And so there's some people who do hard swaps and soft swaps, and that's all a mystery what it means to everybody, you know, in that sort of thing. And then there's a bunch of people who are eager to do a thing, and they find themselves in on a night in a place where everyone's there just to watch, and then everybody's watching, it's like, and nobody's doing, you know, and it becomes frustrating in that way. But I think that there's an analogy there, because I found in Denver, I found that there was a number of platonic BDSM couples. Like, they don't have sex. They never do. They're only there for the scene or for the you know, whatever. And I was like, so, you know, and again, I was trying to figure it all out. I was asking questions in that reporter mode. And I was like, so you don't get off on this? I mean, that's not why I'm here. And again, that's for everybody the same. It's the exact same question. People, they have to ask themselves, why am I here? And what do I want from this space? What does this space allow that I want? What do you want? We get so distracted by what we see. Do you want this or that? Well, no, neither, you know, but that's a false dichotomy. You know, there's more choices than that. And sometimes you have to think them up.
When you go to the clubs, do you go with an intention going already there? Like, you like, okay, here's what I'm looking to do. Or is it contextual? Like, oh, I'm going to go, and if I see someone I'm interested in doing A, B, and C with, I'll do that. Otherwise, I'll do EFG. Or because I would imagine if you're going, you could probably choose what you want to do, you know, for the most part, right? Provided your attraction to someone, but.
So that's the big difference between BDSM and swinging, I will tell you, is the idea of prearranged consent. That's a lot on the BDSM, the negotiation. That's all over here. Most of these people walk into a club maybe with an idea of what they're hoping for the night, but it's like, you know, the smart couples. And again, most of, like a place like Trapeze, you can't go unless you're in a couple. They have nights where it's just, if you're a single dude, super sorry, you can't come in always.
If you're a single woman, can you though?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Often. I figured. Again, as you stated, there's plenty of men out there.
Sure, right.
Yeah. But there's a lot of being open to the moment, meeting somebody, you know, there's a first kiss kind of situation. You go, oh, that didn't, you know, there was the pheromones did not crackle from across the room. We've tried a thing and nope, you know, there's some of that too. And so I think in that, you know, engineering a group thing, is a technique that can be learned and taught, but the chemistry has to be there. You know, and it's in really the formula. By the way, you want to know the formula for that? It's not that hard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. So the people who, you get a couple of couples together, generally the women will be chatting, right? And the men will be, you know, as men are, sometimes less talkative, or they're talking about another thing. And generally when the women get together, the one who seems more secure, they kind of say to the other one, you know, like, oh, your partner's really attractive. How about you and I get together and rock their world? And you kind of be inclusive, and you do a couple of things like that, and then suddenly everybody's involved, and
right.
It's off to the races. And it's a little. I mean, there's a couple of techniques to do this. You know, defining out are they heterosexual? Are they homosexual? Are they, you know, who's into whom, and where are the boundaries for that? And you kind of, it's a very subtle discussion but not like, all right, we're going to do 30 reps with him on top. And then, no, none of that is that negotiated, right? You know? But it's much more casual than on the BDSM side, which is, you know, everybody understands there are rules over there and you don't break those rules. So, you know, but that happens.
It's interesting that it's the, in that swing setting, it's sort of understood that the women have to make the first move. There's still that consent thing is what I'm gathering from what you're saying is that.
A lot of the times, yes. And it's kind of like they're in any given couple, there's one you know, confidence is always a work in progress, always. And, you know, people are at different levels of wanting to pursue or be the hunter or, you know, for lack of a better term, they want to engage. And generally it's a better idea to let the person who's less comfortable take the lead, you know, because then you follow. It's like the weakest link in a chain is where it falls apart. And the person with the least confidence about how they feel about themselves or the situation or their interest or whatever, if you let them set the pace, then everyone follows along behind and is much more comfortable because we know that the, I don't want to say the least of us, but the one who has, you know, maybe the hang up or the insecurity or isn't quite sure. And generally that is the woman because, you know, sex is always a thing with women where the consequences are always more for women. And that's just the nature of the thing. And so when it is the woman, you let the woman lead and make a decision. You can be encouraging as a man or you know, another woman and saying, I think it'll be okay, you know, and we can say stop anytime, you know, and safe word is meatloaf. You know? I'll do anything for love, but I won't do that.
19 minute song.
I know. Right? Love it.
Yeah. The I have a friend who's a bi male who's in the swinging community and he's very open about being bi. Right. For a long time, he was not. And then he decided, you know what? Fuck it. I'm just going to be open about it. And he said that there, when he was open, two things happened. One, he stopped being invited to some parties and events, right? Mm-hmm. And the other thing that happened is he started getting secret private messages from couples, right? Who
looking for a unicorn?
We're looking for a male unicorn. They're like, look, listen, you know, I'm from either would be the guy who's saying like, look, I don't want anyone else to know, but I'm also like bi-curious or something like that. Like he'd get a ton of messages or, you know, a message from the female half of the couple saying like, look, this is something I've always wanted to do or see or something like that. So on one hand, it closed a lot of doors, but on the other hand, it opened a lot of as well. Is that still the case? I think you told me this like 5 or 6 years ago or something like that, pre-pandemic. Is it still the case that it's fairly shunned upon or is it more acceptable now? Or
I think my exposure to this is as it always has been. And I saw it recently even that it's really a lot more okay for the women to be together and be observed, you know, especially in a group thing. You know, I've been on travel tours with kinky groups and in that, you know, the women are making out on the bus and it's a show, but not the men. I'll also say that a couple of times I have some trans female, friends, that I took to the club and the club didn't really know what to do with them. So, and again, policy wise about, do you allow men, single men on to come? Well, what do you do with trans women who have had boob jobs and, you know, they look like women, but they're not women. And I still don't think the clubs really know what to do with them. And they weren't, I won't say they were treated badly, but I think they were just kind of like, everybody just kind of moved down the bar, you know, or which is unkind.
You think they would be like more used, at least mentally prepared for the possibility or something, or the institution would be at least, right?
I think gender roles in swinging are stronger than they are in other kink communities. You know, I think there's some traditionalism that still lingers. And again, everyone's happy to have the women make out, you know, still, but this is my experience, you know. Other clubs have different thermostats, I'm going to say, for, you know, tradition where it's traditional to non-traditional and wherever it's set. And you, you know, but I go to a lot of, well, and I'll tell you this too. Working where I do, and my day job is with an Alzheimer's disease research center. and one of the things that we're particularly good at is bringing underrepresented groups into brain research. Right. So mostly as I entered this position, we were looking at Black men, which you don't have to say much more than the Tuskegee experiments to find out why Black men don't want to be involved in research, let alone brain research, about things they're sensitive about. But the other thing that they're trying to get, and they're underrepresented, and that's important because physiology of by race, there is a bit of a factor there. And I can go into detail, but it's really not relevant. But gay men is another that's, and this is one of my passions, which is helping with this idea of gay men who end up with a diagnosis of Alzheimer's or dementia. And I know several who are my age or older, and they say things like, I'm not worried about it. I've been stockpiling opioids. So if I get a diagnosis like that, I'll just check out. And I said, whoa, it doesn't have to, you know, we can tell you what's wrong and we can give you a safety net and we can show you how to, one, prevent it. That's the first thing. And secondly, we can, you know, we can help you along the way if that's what happens. But most of them don't have children to look after them. And most of them, their family has abandoned them or their partners have died because the age group I'm talking about, they lived through the AIDS in the 80s and the 90s. And they're also, interestingly enough, why they need representation in brain research is because, aging of the brain research is because they've been taking PrEP for years. Everybody got their monkeypox vaccine. You know, the rest of the population did not. So what does this vaccine have to do on their long-term life? What is the effects of PrEP on their long-term? They're victims of domestic violence much more often than straight men. What does this do to their brain health? And it's fascinating, and yet they're standoffish for the same reasons that the Black men are. So in that, you know, that's part of the reason that I was hired was because of my queer Rolodex, right? But I hang out in gay bars dealing with, you know, things. I run a nonprofit, which I started for my son. He's 16 now and he's transgender. And so I started a nonprofit. It was the 1st of June. He'd gotten his vaccine and he said, Mom, I want to go and have some pride stuff in the community. Where is there some stuff? I got out on the community pages and I'm like, where's the stuff? The 1st of June, right? And they went, there is none in our neighborhood. None. But if you do a thing, we'll show up and help. And so then 3 weeks later, we're having a potluck in a park. 250 people showed up. We had the first walking parade, pride parade that our community had ever had. And I turned to my son and I go, are you not entertained? And only like a 12-year-old can do. He went, Mom, it's too much. And then so, yeah. And then when 450 people came the next year, he was over, you know? So, yeah.
So obviously Georgia, that's a, I mean, it's I've got friends who live in Georgia who are queer, and they will often talk about there's two sides that they experience, you know, where they can, I suppose that's true for anywhere, right? But especially it's very easy to be queer in New York City, right? Mm-hmm. Compared to if you're going to be, you know, somewhere in the South or something like that. Did you get any pushback from doing it, or were people pretty much like on board? And this was like, of course, yes, of course, this is no big deal, and of course we should do this.
Yeah, we got some pushback. I can talk to two things about the pushback. We didn't really start to see pushback until we had the Royal TEA. Right. And this was for, and again, I was, let's just, you know, before I was in my life, I have been a school teacher as well. And it was my job as a teacher to meet each and every one of these kids where they are. If they're queer, I hold them up. If they're this, you know, whatever, if they're homeless, if they're what, there's all sorts of things. And I recognized fairly early on and through the group Serendipity Doodahs, which is Mothers of Queer Children, wonderful organization, lots of support, and having a transgender child myself, I knew that kids need permission to look at, and I'll even say my other child is autistic, and autistic children look at gender roles and they see the boy box of conditions and the girl box of conditions and they go, false dichotomy. I don't have to do this and I don't have to do that. I can, and they really do reject rules that they think don't apply to them. And then and the ones that do apply to them, they follow like viciously. That's my child. And I started to recognize that one of the things that is incredibly hurtful in the South is when you're born, they put a little football in a boy's crib and a little bow on the girl. And so one of the things I suggested was we have a tea, not a princess tea, because those are as common as rain in here in the South, right? You know, sometimes a little boy wants to come to the princess tea. And as a princess. And sometimes a little girl doesn't want to go to the princess tea as a princess. She wants to be something else. So we called it the Royal Tea and Come As You Are. And one of the lesbian hairdressers in the community said, she owns the whole building, right? She said, I'll use my services here. We'll have little hairdo things. It'll spark a little makeup. And then we'll have this other piece down here. There was an event space that was in the building she owned. When the restaurant that was also in the building found out that we were going to have a child queer event, which is really pushing it for what we were doing, we were just saying, come as you are, however you want to dress, not prince, not princess, just royalty, just kind of doing away with the gender roles. We got pushback. She had a couple of her hairdressers quit over it. The community itself, which was a little bit, there was an antique store and a thing, you know, they were like, and 2 weeks, we sold out this event when we sold the Eventbrite tickets. We sold out in less than 6 hours. So to say there was no demand for this would be wrong. Sold out event. And the event space was technically leased by the restaurant. They said, oh, we've got a paying customer who wants it. So we're going to reject you all because the owner had offered up the space. The lease thing was troublesome. They said, we have a paying customer who wants to have a birthday party. So sad, too bad you can't have the space. Well, that was 2 weeks before the event and we were all in a tizzy. And of course, we went by during, and we had to move the event to another location, to another day of another date. We went by, there was nothing there. Of course. I mean, literally, without lube, they fucked us. And it really did for our organization, it sucked all the air, you know, from our board of directors. You know, I mean, we all looked at that and went, oh, this again, you know, kind of thing. So that was one of the pushbacks we got. And we had protesters who came to the last iteration that we had, the most recent one of the potluck in the park. And we had between, you know, 400 and 600 people showing up and it was jolly. And it was lots of queer families out there that needed a safe place to come and be with other queer families. And we had, you know, great things. Well, we had a protester who came through, told us all we were sinners and, you know, big, you know, I have a bullhorn in case I need to direct people to the parade. Well, he had his old bullhorn and he came and I was like, ooh, and I ran under the pavilion to get my bullhorn. And the cops, we had undercover cops. We've always had undercover police to keep us safe. And then we had actually uniformed police there because they had a, you know, they've understood that we can have a Meet Gwinnett police tent, which has a bunch of policemen in uniform to be there at a moment's notice if we need them. And I thought that was clever of the county to do that for us. And this policewoman starts to go, I mean, I go to get my bullhorn. She stops me and she goes, I need to see your permit. And I went, are you freaking kidding me? That all of a sudden, now that there's a problem, you want to make sure I have a permit? Like, what? Jeez. And I was like, my visceral reaction self said, you're going to hassle me about this now. And I realized after the fact that what she did was she quickly looked at it to find out where the line was. And if he crossed it, they were taking him down. But she didn't know where the line was, and I didn't understand that. But in the moments, and again, my treasurer was great, had made sure I had a copy of the permit in my pocket. And by the time she had figured this out, I had turned around to see this guy coming at the heart of our event to disrupt, to upset, to do all of these things. And my ex-husband, my ex-boyfriend, and my current boyfriend had formed a semicircle around him between them and me. And I looked out and I was like, my boys, there they are standing between me and danger. And again, kind of coming full circle with this conversation. That's a lot of what polyamory looks like, you know? So
I have to say, I mean, I'm not used to the cops being the good people in these stories, you know, especially in the South, right? Granted, I mean, obviously, I don't really spend a lot of time there, but whenever I hear stories, you always hear the bad stories, right? Mm-hmm. So is this a case of they know they have to help? Otherwise, there'll be dire consequences for them, you know, and politically if they don't? Or is it a genuine, sincere desire to actually serve and protect? Or, you know, where does this come from? Because again, I mean, I have my own biases, obviously, but
yeah,
you know, I was surprised where this story went.
Yeah. My experience with, and I'm going to say this is Gwinnett County, Georgia, which is one of the largest counties in Georgia, we have out school board members. At the time, we had the first one we've ever had that was out represented the school where I taught. In fact, there's 21 high school clusters in the county, 23 now, and you know they have board members that oversee this cluster, this group of clusters, this one, this one, this one. So we had an out representative, state representative. So in government, I think they're fighting the good fight for the movement, individuals by engaging in politics. We have more than a few. Now, out in the hinterlands, I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene. And you have to understand about Atlanta, it's much like Taiwan, which is in China, but it's not China. Atlanta is much the same. It is an island here of people who, and I mean, we've got some great queer bars in Atlanta, Friends and, my personal favorite is Mary's in East Atlanta Village. I love going to Mary's and I go and I feel safe there. There's so many people, my sister's room, lesbian bar. And again, you have to remember, we also had here in Atlanta 28 years ago that, you know, the bomber, who the Centennial Park, the Olympic Park bomber, also bombed an abortion clinic and a queer bar. So we have a mixed past here that we're, one, trying to live down, and let's not let that happen again. But yeah, I found that when you approach it up front and say, we're going to do a thing, and we're going to get our permits, and we're going to play by the rules, and we are going to play nice, the police really don't have a choice other than to, you know, we're following our rules. We have our permits. We're not. I was recently in Mexico City and got to see International Women's Day in Mexico City, and it was horrifying. Posters of tens of thousands of missing women, and people in our group were saying, you know, why would you behave and do all this spray paint and deface all these buildings? You know, you're turning people who would be allies into enemies. And my answer to that is, what good were they as allies when tens of thousands of women are still missing,
exactly,
you know, and
exactly,
no one's doing anything about it. So when people make those, I look for that a lot in my thinking, which is always the false dichotomy. It's big with me because people say, are you a man or are you a woman? What, is that the only two choices? Right? Are you pro-Palestine or pro-Israel? You know, is that the only two choices? Why can't I just be a humanist? Yeah. You know, so
right.
Yeah.
Right.
So there's a lot of that for me.
Well, there's also the idea of there is this whole I'm not a liberal. I I'm a socialist. My wife's a commie. We somehow make it work. there is that liberal idea that, what is it? I think it's MLK said that, you know, civility is more important for some liberals than actual change, right? But kudos to you. That's absolutely amazing. I'll get links. Do you have a website that people can go to visit to help support?
Sure. Lilburnpride.com. Lilburnpride. Yeah.
L-I-L-B-U-R-N. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. But I do want to talk about the book. Because,
I did write a book. We forgot all about that. This conversation has been so good. Yeah.
That's a good sign. It's a good sign when you get lost in the conversation. It feels like when I was reading this, because I could tell, I know now you wrote first, it seems, correct me if I'm wrong, you wrote first and then the artists had accompanying art to go with it. But sometimes the art fits so well that it's hard to tell, right? It's almost like, you know, did you write the lyrics first or the song first, right? So you definitely picked the art or the artists pretty well for each one. And it's a series of Fables in the Key of Kink, and it's a series of different stories, some poems that based on real life experiences or partially based on real life experiences?
Yeah. So let me take a half step back and say, this is not my first book, right? I've had novels, I've had other kinds of books. And where I really found joy was meeting my illustrator. I call him my illustrator because we've done several books together now. And we collaborate particularly well. But how we met was he was a soldier. He was deployed. He was in Baghdad, I believe. And he read my book, my novel, and sent fan art. Now, people send fan art for things all the time, right, when you're a writer. And most of it's dreck. But every once in a while, and then they go, well, what do you think of it? And if you go, well, you know, based on what I wrote and what you draw, you know, you give them some feedback and usually they're like, you never hear from them again. So he drew a picture of the airship, a steampunk novel I wrote called Chenda and the Airship Rothman. And he drew a picture of the airship and I really loved it because it was his interpretation of what I had written. And he goes, well, how did I do? Did I get it right? And I said, well, for the most part, you know, there's a few things that you've made on the ship that are in the wrong place. But other than that, you know, it's really great. And I love your interpretation on that. Well, the next morning, another image appeared in my inbox of a redrawing of the ship. And I went, an artist that understands the meaning of the word now and can take feedback, I'm interested here. You know, I was like, you have my attention, sir. And so I was doing a little bit of a book tour in the Pacific Northwest, and I was going to a place where I knew I was going to run into some comic book artists. And I started to, you know, show his work around, and I said, it's good. You should do a project with him. And they said, it's good. Why aren't you doing a project with him? And I said, why am I not doing a project with him? So I took one of his images, and this is how we've played ever since. I took one of his images, I wrote a piece, sent it to him. He sends back a reinterpretation of the art he'd already done. Like there was a mechanical man. And that became the first, he's fascinated with the number 7, right? So the character that became St. John Murphy Alexander had the 7, and suddenly it went from this mechanical soldier clanking thing to something that really appealed to a child's eye based on what I'd written. And so from that came a bunch of other things. We had the steam duck, we had the seek and find. We did the whole book while he was deployed. You know, we made a lot of this together while he was, you know, he had a pencil and a pipe to smoke and a notebook, and he did all these drawings. So from there, things kind of went on. He'll be like, Emily, the next time we do a book, I want it to have cityscapes, a mechanical mouse, some trains in it. And I was like, we're writing by categories now. I was like, and it kind of went like that. And so it's evolved that way. So I got very accustomed to working with him. And then when I finally said, you know, I've been kicking around this idea about some kinky stories. You want to illustrate that? He went, Emily, I did not sign up for flirtation and unlawful gyrations. And I was like, he doesn't really sound like that, but I just do that to different, he's from Southern Louisiana. So a little bit like that. So yeah, he said, I'm not going to do that. But then it felt like to do a whole book with another illustrator felt like cheating on him or somehow, you know, I was like, so I went out and I went out to an illustrators group on Facebook and said, I'm looking for somebody, some illustrators who want to take a walk on the kinky side. And then suddenly my inbox was filled with still lifes of genitals. And I was afraid to open some of these direct messages because, another person has sent me a penis portrait. it did take a while to find people who understood the difference between artistic genitals and an illustration that told the story. So in that, I kind of picked some from around the world. Now, a couple of these people I know, a couple of these people I found through these different illustrator groups. And we would go back and forth. And some of them, it was really difficult for me to convey what I needed their art to do, which was take my story and have the image help tell the story. And that was difficult. But when I found the ones that could do it, they did it really well. And I will say, though, one of these images was one that I had seen years ago. A friend of mine did draw the perimenopausal period monster, that demon. Oh, yes. That I saw years ago. And when I saw it, I had written a perimenopausal period monster for a friend. And I saw that and I went, that's it right there. That's it. That's the monster. That's exactly what I want. And then it took me about 5 years to convince him to let me use it for the piece. And in the end he did, but I paid him, you know, because people will do things for money, you know, it's great that way.
It is a perfect match for the story. Did you have, I almost get the feeling, correct me if I'm wrong, but you probably have a lot more stories than are in this book. Was it a case of, this is the artwork that works with these stories, and so I'm going to eliminate these stories? Or were you like, these are the stories I want in, and I'm not going to stop until I find the right artwork for it?
A bit of column A, a little bit of column B. It's much like Star Wars. It's a nice standalone film, you know? And then you get seasons 2 and, you know, or episodes 5 and 6 there, you know, which depend on each other, but you have to get the first one out there to see if it floats. So I picked things that worked with the art. I picked things that I really wanted to put out there. I picked there's always more. I can always write more. Write more. What I learned in the children's book business is how unimportant the author is to the children's book business. It's all about Kevin's art. You know, he's really great there. And to some extent, that's true. But then again, you have to, when he wants to draw all these things, well, I have to get a story that holds them all together. And that's been a fun way to write because it makes me bend. It makes me do other things. So in this, I knew the minimum number of pages I would need. I knew that I wanted it to be like a 2-page spread for everyone. And frankly, if you open the book at any point, you might not know, like, okay, that's one book. And then you do 2 pages like, oh, that's a different, the art isn't the same. The meter isn't the same. The story isn't the same. And so each one had to have its own voice, to which I got that a little bit. And every piece of art that people sent me when I commissioned them, especially the vanilla corner of Kinky Town, I died when I opened the email. This young lady is in the Philippines who did this piece for me. And, you know, she would say, I'm working on it, but I have to do my chores. I don't really know how old she is, and I'm not going to ask. Because I don't know the answer to this. But she drew this thing, and I died because what could be more vanilla than a Hello Kitty store?
It's really amazing. I mean, the first page I saw was the crypto nymphomaniac, or how to have sex with imaginary creatures, which is something that has come up in conversation surprisingly high number of times when you have a bunch of nerdy kinky friends.
Right.
And so this was especially entertaining. But one thing I did like is how there is, even though all the stories come from you, it does feel like you're in different moods and different headspaces when you write them.
Yeah.
And, And it was interesting because sometimes you don't, whenever you do get a book, something like this, or a book of stories of someone, it's usually the same tone. I think also the fact that you do have different artists does make a huge impact on it. Mm-hmm. But there are things that I, in it, when I was like, wow, I'm curious, what was the inspiration for some of these, right? Like, well, obviously the crypto nymphomaniac obviously you haven't experienced that, but was this something that came up in conversation, or was this
just contraire?
Oh, here we go. Here we go.
So this is the intersection of two thoughts. And I love things that come together like this, right? It has long, you know, especially in the swinger community or just cads in general, men who are cads in general, right? It often seems like when I'm on a dating site or something like that, it's like, this guy has a bingo card. What he needs to complete the set today is an albino Asian woman amputee. I mean, it's like, that's what they're not looking for your personality or, you know, a life partner. It's like they're checking a box. And I have encountered far too many of those. But I had that thought in my head. And then I saw this article. Was about a guy in Ireland who was a little person, and he had grown his little orange beard out a bit. And the article said he was arrested because he had, and 26 different women came forward and said, "Oh yes, he said if I could have sex, if I would have sex with him, he'd show me his pot of gold." And I'm thinking, you're playing a leprechaun to get laid. I love it. I mean, but there's enough women out there who are like, okay.
I mean, look, worth a shot. You know,
a shot. Yeah.
Right.
And, you know, you present somebody with a limited amount of time and say, you know what? What are you doing? I had a guy, a friend of mine in graduate school, and he was from Yugoslavia. And I said, babe, Yugoslavia hasn't existed in 10 years. He goes, if America ceases to exist, where will you say you're from? You know, and it's like, okay, I got this. But he would walk across campus and he goes, I have 2 hours. Would you like to exchange bodily liquids with me? And and I mean, he had a head like Charlie Brown and a body like a pencil, and he got laid more than anyone I know because he would put a time limit on it. Just try for 2 hours. It's fine. We'll do this now. And so he would do it. And so you put a time limit on it, people are much more willing. I don't have to put up with you forever. Just a couple hours, and there might be a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow here. Right. So, and that's where that one came from. And it's kind of, it fed into that idea of, I say in this little sweet story in verse, you know, once you kind of go down that path, there's no going back, you know, like I want variety. I want difference. I want this experience that's kind of out of this world. And there's a lot of that. There's a lot to be said for that. Yeah.
There are other stories like The Clit Whisperer, which was also the artwork
based on a real person.
That was what I was going to say. It sounded like, because I have friends who, because if you're in the kink community or probably in the swinger community as well, you have people who have specializations, right? Whether it's, oh, this person is really good at spanking or whatever. And this, it read like, I mean, it is, you do say with apologies to Gilbert and Sullivan, but the it does read like, this was someone you met who you had heard was very good at one thing, this very specific thing, and the rest is history. I mean, that's what it felt like, the backstory to it, because it feels so not clinical isn't the right word. I mean, maybe I'm saying clinical because of the image that goes with it.
The gloves, right? Yeah. And it was. It's funny. This is a guy who I met at the Denver convention. And we brought him back to Atlanta for the Atlanta convention. And he is a guy who has studied women's anatomy. Like, he did a whole series of photographs, kind of followed that idea of the 9 types of pussy. And it's how the outer labia and the vulva present, what it relates to in terms of smell, taste, the distance from the vaginal opening to the G spot. I mean, clinical as can be, you know, by saying a lot of these are predictable things. talked about ideal porn pussy, which is real fine and real small. But the reaction, why did, it's like, which came first, the horse or the cart? I don't know. It's all a big fuck job. But, you know, and he would say, this has become the thing that we see most often in porn, because women who have this physical structure are outward projecting orgasmers. And, you know, he would demonstrate, you know. Funny thing is, even in a kink group, 40% of the women have never taken a mirror, put it down there, and even looked. They've never looked. And he was saying, your pussy is perfect. Just because you see this in porn, there's a reason it's in porn. And it's because the women behave this way when they have this sort of architecture. And he said, if you take longer to climax because of the nature of your anatomy, that's fine. And he, you know, talked through this. And at the time, I'm staying in the hotel. We're doing the conference and we're doing all of this. And literally the guy I was dating broke up with me, right? He broke up with me. He shows up at the con. I'm upset. I'm in tears. I'm in the hotel room alone in tears. Knock, knock, knock on the door. It's the clit whisperer and his wife. And she sat down in the chair and he came in and like snap, put the gloves on. And I mean, literally from the time that I was crying when he knocked on the door, 20 minutes later, I'm having a hell of an orgasm. And again, he didn't get undressed. He was there. He had a toy and a tool and some gloves. And then we went from zero, I mean, less than zero to 100. And again, this is what knowledge gives you. This is what science study, scientific method will do. And in that, I've kind of codified him as, because he is. He shows up someplace. And again, two suitcases and a plan in hand. That is literally what he did.
But he ordered an orgasm?
Did somebody here order the 8:15 orgasm? Right. You know.
So did you write, how long after the experience did you write? Did you write the story? Or was this sort of cooking in the back of your brain the whole time? And then once you decided to write the book, you said, oh, I have to include this in there.
No, this is, so some of these pieces have been sitting around for a long time. And I think the perimenopausal period monster is probably the oldest. It's at least 5, if not 8 years old. So, you know, and I played with a lot of other things that didn't make it into the book, but from this book, there's that. So after my experience with the Clit Whisperer and the convention ended, I kind of was feeling good and jolly about it. And of course the tone of the whole thing's pretty darn jolly. Yeah, it developed, and I will say I didn't finish it. This was maybe four or five years ago I started it. And then, of course, until you get bits and pieces laying around all the time. So the perimenopausal period monster was one that I had done and perfected to my satisfaction. I won't say it's perfect, but it's to my satisfaction, and I'll be honest about that. You know, always, nothing is ever done when you're a writer. You can just keep changing one word, one syllable, just stop it, just publish it, just be done with it. You got to let it go into the world, or you'll die a horrible death. You know, these are the feelings you have as a writer, you know, let it go or die. So yeah, they, and some of them up until I was doing the layout and still dickering with one little thing, the meter here is off. It's no, it's right. It's like, oh no, I don't know. Yeah. That way lies madness. And it does.
I mean, the good thing as the reader is, of course, we don't see that. We just see the finished product, and that there it is, right? And so we don't see the I don't know if anguish is the right word to use from your perspective, but we don't see that. We see a finished product, and it's great, you know.
Don't watch them make the sausage. Never watch them make the sausage, you know.
But you have there's a lot of things in here that it does feel like. There's going to be, let me rephrase. I do hope there's going to be a book too, because it felt like this is like the tip of the iceberg of what, not just your experiences, but also like when I read the Grammar Dominatrix, that was really good one. I don't know if you'd call it the ode to, well, the showers, growers, and flamethrowers.
Yes.
there's a lot in here, especially if it's not just nerdy stuff. I want to say too, you also have like an experience. Correct me if I'm wrong. That was the beast who's trying to be good.
Yes.
Someone online who it was like an online experience you had, at least at first.
Yes. And then getting to know them, and everybody walks into these situations where you meet somebody. And again, this kind of loops back to the swinger scene. You have an idea in your head about how you're going to be. And then my father, who was a colonel, you know, he would say, you know, no plan survives first contact with the enemy.
Right.
And that is true. You walk in and then suddenly, you know, what you thought would be, you know, you're excited about a person and all the words were good. And then you meet in person and fizzle, right? Or the opposite. I've come out of a long relationship. I want to take things slow and a step at the time. And oh my God, I want to hump her leg. You know?
Right. Right.
So this was the struggle of a wonderful man who was trying to be good, trying to take it slow, didn't want to jump into anything too fast like he did before, you right. know? But then there's me, you know, sitting on his lap. And then there's a whole struggle. Trying to be good. I don't know why you think you should. You're a lot better when you're a beast. And I'm a woman who likes a little monster in her man, you know, in terms of, you know, aggressive, be bossy, be whatever, you know. I like that because, you know, I'm a person all day long. Trying to make things function in the world, in the family, and in the neighborhood, and rights for people whose rights are being trampled on. Otherism is something I can't abide because it's a bunch of people who are using one yardstick to measure themselves and another yardstick to measure someone else. And to me, maybe I have a heightened sense of injustice, but yeah, the older I get, the more I take the cards that I'm dealt and try and play them as best I can. And I relaxed about that. I stopped trying to push a rope, you know,
right.
And so playing them as they are. And my thought is when the pheromones are crackling, you know, go with it, recognize that we're adults and it'll be great. Or it won't. And then tomorrow we make more decisions with the cards we have. So yeah, that's where that one came from.
Was it a difficult decision to use your real name?
It was. I write children's books. This book could be bad for business, you know?
Sure.
And again, you talk about a second book, and I realized in this book, and it was a very conscious choice, was to be flirty and kinky, but not obscene. And so where will that line be in the second book? Will I be more comfortable? Well, we got to see how this one floats when it comes out. What is it? 2 weeks from today? No, a week from today. Holy smokes. It's a week away. Anyway, or whatever today is, something close.
It'll
to
be
that,
out. Yeah. It'll be out now. So when people are listening to this, it'll be out now. Considering that you write children's books, did you get a lot of pushback from other people saying, look, don't do this, or don't use her. You come up with a fake name, or no?
No. So the people who knew these stories, because again, you know, you put a glass of wine in me and we're at the retirement party for someone, I'm going to read the perimenopausal period monster, and the women howl. I mean, women who understand this phenomenon. I had a conversation with a woman today. Women are like this. We can be in the grocery store line for like 20 minutes and I'll know her menstrual history. You know, like, I will, you know, we talk about these things, but we get to this stage in life and we go, what fresh new hell is this? You know? And so that one was always a hit. And so those folks who knew this were like, we're eager for the book. If this more like the perimenopausal, we're down for it. People who I know that I'm close to at work, I go, I'm writing a new book, but it's not like the children's books. And then I hand them this thing and they go, Fables in the Key of Kink. And literally, if they have 10 fingers on the book, suddenly they only have four. You know, it's like they, right. they hold it because they're afraid of what I encountered, which was a bunch of penis portraits. And people don't want that. So I very deliberately, and again, Marja the Bondage Butterfly, these pictures are darling. My friend in Kentucky, she actually happens to be the graphic designer for the state of Kentucky at the State House, right? She painted those. She doesn't do that at work, but she did these. And she's done pencil drawings, and she's a very multi-talented artist. But she came up with these, and I thought, I could put these in a children's book and no one would know. I mean, unless you notice the cat of nine tails there in the, right. in the web. But yeah, so they vary from, they're suggestive but not lewd. And so my colleagues who don't know me and don't know these stories, they kind of were wary and they kind of held it at arm's length to make sure it didn't grab them or, you know, make them gay or something. I don't know. So, but I don't know. In the next one, will I push the envelope a little bit more? Will I, I don't know. We'll see.
I hope there is a next one. I hope everyone listening buys a copy. And because I do feel like this is it does feel like a tip of the iceberg type of situation. It does feel.
I hope so. I would love this to be.
There's a lot more there. I mean, I want to stress. It doesn't feel like when you read it and you go through it, it doesn't feel like, oh, is that it? That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying that there's like, oh, I hope there's more. Then because there's it's really good. So, but thank you so much for taking the time and talking about it. I mean, you're right. It's not lewd. But it is definitely like it's a book where if you are kinky and you have vanilla family that don't know you coming over and you have to de-kink the apartment, you could leave this on the bookshelf and it would not be embarrassed. But at the same time, it's still there, right? So it's not lewd, but if you know your mother reads it, comes upon it, you're like, oh, it's just a fun, you know. Fun book. So,
well, if your mother reads it, she's going to laugh out loud at the perimenopausal period monster.
Definitely. My wife was the first thing she read, and she really enjoyed it. So,
good.
But thank you again for taking the time. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it was really, really great to be here. Thank you.
Do 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 do